They change cultures. They're heat seekers. They run at adversity and embrace change. These are the Room Tilters.
Somebody who can change the temperature in a room when they walk in. I mean, that's metaphorical for somebody who can influence those around them and make it such an impact quickly, emphatically, and long-lasting, whether it be an organization, a team, a relationship, whatever it might be.
This is the Room Tilters podcast, presented by Limitless Minds. Co-hosts DJ Eitzen and Harry Wilson, founders of peak performance and leadership consulting company, Limitless Minds, explore how the best and brightest change the temperature in a room. From sports, the military, entertainment and media, clinical psychologists to CEOs, this podcast will navigate what it takes to think big and go far. And now, DJ and Harry.
All right, on today's Room Tilters podcast, we have Dr. Sheila Davis. She's gone from nurse to CEO of Partners in Health. And I'm really excited for you guys to listen to Sheila because, she has this great story, right? She's kind of been everywhere, from Haiti to West Africa. She's impacting all these communities. And what's neat, I think, is that, you know, she's kind of consistently been, you know, the face or the lead or a leader in the face of crisis. And I think it's timely for where we're at today in the back end of 2020. Regardless of when you're listening to this, this is the back end of 2020 when we're recording it. And we've been watching leadership or a lack of leadership, depending on your perspective, in this crisis. And so we get a chance to ask her a little bit about that. We get a chance to ask her about being a woman in leadership. Mm-hmm. We get a chance to talk to her about her experience, really working directly with patients with HIV in the 80s when we didn't even, healthcare environment didn't even know what they were really dealing with. So it was really neat. DJ, what were some of your thoughts and why should people kind of stick in and listen to this thing?
Yeah, I think what you're gonna see with Sheila is her heart and how she's followed her passion. You know, Harry, a lot of people that we talk to are like, you know, I don't know what I wanna do. I want to build a business, but I'm not really sure what it is. I think what I really respect about her is that she follows her passion, and she uses that passion in every aspect of her job, whether she's leading people, when she was treating patients. She talks about her empathy and how that has helped her become a better leader and a better professional, a better mom. So I think she hit us on a lot of different levels, Harry, and I'm really excited for the listeners to kind of get a sneak peek of her.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Sheila Davis, enjoy.
All right. Welcome to the Room Tilters. We have Dr. Sheila Davis today. We're really excited to have you today here on the podcast and have a nice conversation with you. How are you doing today, Sheila?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So do we call you doctor? Should we call you Dr.
No.
Davis?
Because I know just some call me Sheila.
You earned that though. You earned that.
But I'm a nurse who's a doctor. And so, you know, I use the doctor when I have to in rooms, but I'm much more comfortable with Sheila. So thank you.
All good. Well, Harry knows how much I love nurses. I'm married to a nurse.
Oh.
Okay. Now for let's see, I think it's about 16 years. And so I got an affinity for that. And also Sheila, it's hard to say the name Sheila without, you know, wanting to sing the Oh Sheila song all morning long.
I've been, Oh Sheila.
That's true.
We love you too.
Yeah.
So that's been in my mind like all morning long. So, but you know, really we want to get to know a little bit more about you, Sheila. Tell us a little bit about like just where you're from, you know, how you grew up. Give us a little bit of your background.
Yeah, so I grew up in rural Maine. My parents were from Rhode Island and grew up with three siblings. And my dad was a university professor. And we were kind of the liberal family in the midst of rural Maine and had the no nuke sign and the Save the Seals t-shirts and kind of the whole thing. So I look back and I think, you know, they were quite brave to go to a place where we were really different in some senses, but that's where I grew up from the age of four. So consider Maine my home for many years.
Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I remember DJ back in college. So I went to University of Richmond, Sheila, and played football and baseball there. And in our conference, we played Maine.
Oh, so you did UMO.
We'd fly into Maine, the Black Bears, right?
Yeah, Maine Black Bears.
We'd fly into Maine. And it was never not like, because we play them in October, November,
freezing.
Not cold or wet or a combination of both, windy. but Maine in the summer, there's not like a better,
true,
there's not a whole lot of better places than Maine in the summer.
Yeah.
Get you a lobster roll, DJ.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
With no mayo.
Well,
can you do a lobster roll?
No, we do that, mayo in Maine.
Yeah, yeah. 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 I mean, you can do that. You can do that, DJ, but
yeah,
you don't. That's not. That's
right.
Not. Come on.
Totally.
That's
totally.
Right. That's great. Now, so yeah, and so you grew up in Maine, and then so tell us about a little bit about this Partners in Health. I mean, how did you get there? You're an activist. You know that you're somebody that builds things. So tell us a little bit about this Partners in Health.
Yeah, so I had started in nursing school working in the HIV field, which was, moved to Boston, went to school, totally new world. And then my whole career was around HIV and AIDS. Had known about Partners in Health for many years, but was worked in global health, not at PIH, and then was really struck by it really is a mission organization, not in a religious sense, but in the sense of really people believe health is a human right and social justice is the way to go, and saw that it's not just talking about it, but everybody really lives it, you know, and started there 10 years ago as a coordinator and had to take a, you know, 2/3 of a pay cut to work there, which as a single mother was not the brightest, you know, financial move. Right. But really found a place where it's amazing. And everybody works so hard all over the place. And we're in 11 countries. And every day I'm just struck by amazing people really committed to their community. And so I just felt home there and stayed for 10 years and then, you know, became the CEO in a weird twist of fate. But it resonated with something I was passionate about. So it made sense.
How is COVID impacted the business this year? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, we started getting ready, you know, when we started hearing about this in January, February, really worried about Sierra Leone and Haiti and Peru and places where we don't have ICUs. You know, we don't have the same health system or the net. And, spent a lot of time and energy and, you know, our 11 countries, every morning we had a call where Peru was, you know, talking about what was happening there, talking to people in Mexico, talking to Haiti. And, it's tough because there's not a health system that can, take care of a pandemic such as this. Mm-hmm. And then come to find out that the U.S. couldn't handle it either. And we were asked to come in and work in Massachusetts by the governor here. And then after that, we're asked to come in and work in a bunch of other states, municipalities. And we really learned why we were asked to come in Massachusetts. It's because our Haiti colleagues who learned how to, you know, contact trace cholera, working in West Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, really taught us how to deal with Ebola. And other parts of the world have done a much better job than the US. And I think it's because care is embedded in the community. There's a community model, and we still need ICUs in Sierra Leone. Like we 100% need that. But the US needs to learn a lot from other parts in the world where we have community health workers. And we're really there's more of a care for the community and care for each other that I think in the U.S. we've had trouble with.
Mm. Yeah. And speaking of care, you know, my mom's a nurse. She has a nursing background.
Good.
She went to, I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, and she was in nursing school at Xavier. And then she worked in the hospital at the University of Cincinnati. And
happy birthday, Miss Tammy.
Her birthday was yesterday.
Happy birthday, Miss Tammy.
Actually, no, that was, what's today? Today was, that was birthday. Birthday was Wednesday.
It's been a long week.
Yeah.
It's been a long week.
Yeah. But she's been a nursing her whole career. And, wow. And then she went to do some case management stuff at Blue Cross Blue Shield Anthem. And then now she moved out to Washington, where near my brother, and she's working. She's at the University of Washington, and working in the medical center there. And during this COVID pandemic, you know, she was called down. She was testing patients. She was on the front lines testing patients, And, you know, but the reason why I'm saying that is because I know my mom, and as a nurse, or naturally, you know, she's a caregiver, right? Yeah. And so during times like this, she's spending so much time work kind of concerned and worrying about other people and putting all of her energy there, but not maybe not as much from in a self-care perspective. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, like, how are you? Like, how have you been handling 2020? And because 2020 is not just about the pandemic, right? Yeah. 2020 has offered social injustice and the politics, and then of course the ripple effects of COVID-19. How are you doing? And how are you coping, and what have you done to try to focus on yourself a little bit where you can?
Yeah, you know, it's been hard in many senses because I used to spend so much time traveling. So, And it was much easier traveling and being in the thick of it than watching from the sidelines in many ways, which seems weird probably. But I found it harder, you know, running an effort from here than I did during Ebola in West Africa, where I was most of my time in Sierra Leone. And people, you would think that would have been so much harder. And in many ways it was so much harder, physical risk, et cetera. But being in the middle of it and feeding off the energy of like amazing people you're working with day to day is easier than staring at a computer for me, who's like a doer. And I think that's been hard of seeing things from, I almost feel like there's like a space in between, because I don't do direct patient care anymore, but worry so much about the nurses and the nurses' aides and so many of the people out there that don't have the equipment to keep themselves safe, when it doesn't have to be that way. And it's, I think that the fury that I feel about that has, there's not an outlet. And I think that I've realized that it's easier for me to be in the middle of it than to be on the outside. So I think that's why this has been hard.
Yeah. What would you say? And you're located in Haiti, right? Is that where do you actually run your
No, we're we're in 11 countries. I'm based in the US.
You are based in the US. Okay. Yeah. What would you say though, when you're dealing with some of these other countries and obviously bringing a tremendous resource and resources, What would you want just a common person to know, you know, some of the struggles, some of the challenges there, you know, and some of the things that you guys are doing?
Yeah, you know, I think the places where we're really fortunate to work is, you know, Haiti, for example. People say, oh, Haiti, you know, they can't get their act together and that type of thing. And really, the work that's done in Haiti has influenced 10 other countries for Partners in Health. The Haiti team, the physicians and nurses and others are the ones that started our program in Rwanda, in Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Like, Haiti is an amazing place. And the challenges Haiti has had is because of a lot of the, you know, the US and a lot of the structures of you know, the financing and World Bank and things that have made a lot of countries stay poor, stay dependent. And that's frustrating because there's tremendous amount of expertise in many room tilters in Haiti and in all the places we work. And so it's hard because I'm not the expert. Like, I'm a conduit, you know, but the experts are people who are in the University Hospital in Mirabelais or in Sierra Leone or Rwanda. And so I think it's amazing, and people know what to do. People have the answers. Mm-hmm. And so they need the resources, and we need to change our whole funding structure, and we need to change how the world takes care of each other. Yeah. You know, because it's insane that we really have created such a structure where, you know, we've created a place where people can't take care of their own people.
Right. Right. How do we change that? How do we change that mindset? You know what I mean? Like, you think about it, because you know, we see a lot of the room tilters we have on, they are so much more open to other cultures, other ideas, diversity of thought, and you know, so how do we change, you know, how we look at the situation that you just outlined?
Yeah, you know, I think that hopefully that what COVID has done is shown that we're not the experts. Mm-hmm. You know, many of us already knew that in terms of healthcare and taking care of people. But now I think the world has seen it. So if we can be humble enough and have enough humility as a country to say, yeah, we can learn a lot from Rwanda, we can learn a lot from Lesotho. And, you know, and not one place or people have all the answers, But if we could really keep the core of health as a human right, that we really need to have global health equity and get the best from Rwanda, the best from the US, like how do we, I think if we use this opportunity as an inflection point to say, we have a lot to learn, we can improve tremendously, but we really are our brothers and our sisters' keeper. Mm-hmm. We're a global world, you know, pandemics move. And you know, we're dependent on each other in a way that I think now maybe people see. So I think, you know, I'm an eternal optimist that we can, people can mobilize, and we can see that the disparities in health in the US are alarming and ridiculous, and we're responsible to change those, not just talk about them. And so if we let COVID happen and then we don't use this to change maternal mortality in Black Americans, change the disparities, like shame on us. Like we have to, I think, not fall back and just say, oh, that's too bad, and now this is over, but really use this as a mobilization. And I think there's movements. And I think the joining of Black Lives Matters with climate, with global health equity, we're all fighting for the same things. Right. And so we all need to get on the, you know, move together and support each other. And I think we can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that message. I love that message. You might have to run for office here. It's coming up soon. you might be ready. You might be ready. You might be ready. 2024.
They're still counting votes, man.
So listen, so, you working in leading in Haiti and response and, you know, the response to Ebola in West Africa and all the things you've done, you've done a lot of leading through crisis, it sounds like, you know, and you know, how have those experiences shaped how you've respond, how you and the teams around you, people around you have responded to this particular crisis, right? You know, or challenge, I should say. What have you learned that you can pass on to some of our listeners that's kind of like that shaped some of your principles and philosophies around handling crisis?
Yeah, you know, I think why I think I'm good at crisis is because I'm a nurse. And I think as nurses, we are good communicators. We build teams. We're able to quickly triage and look at shifting priorities. And I think dealing with emergencies, that's what's constantly happening. So I think, you know, probably the biggest lesson I've learned is listen a lot more than I talk, and, you know, listen to the people who are in the most proximity to what's happening, rather than decisions being made thousands of miles away. Yeah. I think is key. And that should happen whether it's downtown Newark, New Jersey, where we're working, or it's in, you know, Sierra Leone. So I think listening more, having the decision-making and the input be pushed as proximal to where the people who are impacted have to live with the results has been key. And I think also realizing that it's no one can do this alone, and not one organization, not one place. So I think being willing to work with others and you know, not having to be in the forefront or you know, doing what we can and joining forces, but really the decisions and the priorities have to be by those who are living there all the time and doing it. And so, and they have the answers. Yeah. Often it's just listening and filtering maybe a place of privilege where I can get a seat at the table. You know, as a nurse, I always make sure that there's a nurse from Sierra Leone with me, because I'm not unique. It's just that I have a place that I can get at that table. So I think doing that and really pushing that, there's people have the answers, we just don't listen.
That's really good. We've heard you say in the research that disasters can bring the best out of people. All right. Disasters can bring the best out of people. Why would you say that? Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, I think they can also bring out the worst in people, but I think they can bring out the best in people, and it strips away, hopefully, a lot of the ego. Because when you're in the middle of something, whether it's Ebola and you're about to go in the Ebola treatment unit, or if it's, you know, Haiti post earthquake or whatever, you know, if it strips away a lot of the noise. And I think that people rise to the occasion. And I think it's often looking around to see who can function really well in that situation. And it may not be the most obvious person. You know, the drivers at PIH by far are the, I think, are our heroes. One, they're, you know, they're from those local communities. I learned so much about the history of Liberia that I never would have known from reading something. And it's people who remain calm and are always keeping their focus on what the main issue is. And it's around a person or people. And it's not worrying about, you know, the photo op on the tarmac, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? It's this mm-hmm. person who's, you know, driving all night to make sure the nurses get to where they need to go. And I think there's, if you look around in situations like that, you see where people are putting or keeping the core of what we need to be doing at the forefront. And it's often people who are not the ones who were leading in normal times, because it's hard in a disaster.
Sheila, I got a question for you. So you went from nurse to CEO, right? And obviously different stops along the way, and you know, you've been a chief nursing officer, you've been a chief of clinical operations, right? And probably some other roles in between. Tell us a little bit about some of that journey and kind of, you know, how you decided to go from, you know, nurse and maybe being kind of like on the floor, if you will, to in the, you know, leading a group of you know, caregivers and medical staff and so on and so forth. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, I think, you know, I always say that I live by the Spider-Man kind of theory of leadership, because if someone said map out your career, like there's no way in hell I'd be where I am now, because it didn't make sense necessarily, decisions I made. But I always followed, I think, the passion, and it was HIV and social justice, and I followed that, and I was like, where can I learn more? Or, you know, I became a nurse practitioner because I wanted to be able to treat people and this kind of thing. So I think, you know, because I live by that philosophy, I think it prepared me to be a CEO. Whereas if I had said, oh, I want to go from being a staff nurse to, you know, the leading a hospital or something, I couldn't have created this patchwork of what happened. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I still identify as a nurse because I think that's important. And I think that I'm good at what I do because I'm a nurse, but there's, you know, being not in the action is hard because I'm kind of a doer and I'm a problem solver and I love being in the middle of everything. And that isn't my job anymore. And so that's been hard because I think that's what feeds me. And so I've had to think about, how do I remain and feed off the energy of amazing, you know, we have 19,000 employees around the world. And so most of those are community health workers and drivers and cooks and et cetera. So still finding a way to feed off what they're doing is probably the biggest challenge, that because I'm not in the thick of it anymore. So I think the higher you go up, the less connection you have, which seems crazy. Right. You know what I mean? So how do we change that, I guess, is part of the question.
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, it's something to really think about too. And it's so true when you're in the grind and like on that level, you're right in it. So you're very in touch, and you have to be really intentional as you move up the ladder.
Yeah. Right?
Especially as you're moving an organization. What is it that you like most, like about your role as a leader? Where do you find the most purpose and passion, you know, in your day to day?
You know, I think seeing where in a place of privilege, I can pave the way for somebody else or identify somebody else who's a leader or somebody else who has huge potential, but probably wouldn't have been noticed before.
Okay.
Is amazing. So we've created an opportunity for nurse leaders within Partners in Health, which typically had been a physician. You know, people know Partners in Health for being doctor oriented. Even though we have more nurses than doctors, even though, you know, so part of it is being able to point to that and say, we have amazing nurse leaders and how do we find a place for them to grow? Where do we look at, I changed the leadership structure as soon as I started. And so that our executive directors or our leaders in Lesotho and Malawi, et cetera, those are now the leaders of the organization. Mm-hmm. So I kind of flipped the structure so that it's decentralizing the leaders and putting them as the proximal as we could. Yeah. So I was able to do that because I'm in this position. And if I wasn't, I couldn't have ever done that. And it's not all my great ideas. It was because I lived and traveled and worked with people for 10 years. And so my ideas of the ideas of, you know, 19,000 people who I've, you know, worked with. And so I think it's, I take that seriously, that I do have a responsibility to pave the way and make sure people are seen that typically wouldn't be seen.
Yeah.
Love that. I love that. You know, that's a part of like the servant leadership kind of, you know, pathway and roadmap. And, you know, certainly we subscribe to that for sure. You know, one thing I was going to ask you on a personal level too, because I have an experience with a family member who passed away from AIDS, from HIV. And this was, you know, I was telling before we started, I was telling about my dad has three brothers. So four brothers total that went to boarding school up near you and in Massachusetts and then went to Dartmouth. Well, the youngest brother, Richard, passed away in 2005. I think it was 2005. And I just remember being old enough to like recognize, you know, and go visit him in his last days and watching this individual that I've known for so long that had so much life just kind of waste away, right? And this is 2005. So here you are, you're working with HIV patients in the 80s before, you know, and you know, every day there was probably more and more education coming around it, and you're and so I've always been amazed at how nurses or those that are in healthcare and frontlining with patients in different ways, like how you separate, you know, your own personal kind of response and emotion to watching individuals, you know, go through that journey. And then, but then also being a professional in what you do and being able to stay neutral, but something we talk about a lot in our business relative to adversity and different things, stay neutral, stay kind of on the path, stay the course and all these different things. How do you compartmentalize watching patients that you may or may not build some sort of relationship with, and then just doing your job? How do you do that?
Yeah, you know, I think in some ways, I don't think we should separate it. I don't. Okay. I think if you're at the point where you don't grieve when somebody's dying and is dying young and is kind of losing their life ahead of them, I think you have to feel that. You do have to, you know, have some barriers. But I think, to me, when you're not able to, when it doesn't impact you anymore, you probably need to get the hell out, because you're probably not effective in that sense. That doesn't mean you, I mean, I think you have to deal, you don't become attached to this, to everybody the same way, obviously. But I think it's a privilege to be with somebody who is at the end of their life. And I think if you don't, you know, whether it's just taking a moment to, you know, to reflect on and wish them well, and, you know, and being caring or something, if we can't do that at that moment and you're seeing it as a job, then that's probably, you probably shouldn't be in that position. I think that's hard though. It takes a personal toll. And, you know, it's my daughter who's 29, who, you know, I ended up being a single mother. I was worried that I put the weight of the world on her because she traveled with me and, you know, lived in South Africa. She's kind of been all over the place. And one time I remember I had, you know, had a tough day at work, and she was like 11 or something. And I picked her up and she was like, oh, so-and-so didn't sit with me at the cafeteria. And I got all irritated. And she said, you know, Mom, I just need to be 11. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, what did I do to my child to put this weight of the world? And so I obviously didn't handle it as well as I could have probably in some senses, but, you know, she's an amazing woman now who's, you know, is lived in Haiti for 4 years, and her fiance is in Haiti, and we're trying to get him over here if we can get the immigration stuff figured out in this crazy country. Yeah. But I think I'm glad, I would rather have erred on the side of that than not feeling. And so I think that's the, you know, the toll that I think it takes. But I think sometimes we're afraid to be human, or be even as a leader afraid to be human. And I think I make mistakes all the time, every day. And I say that, I'm always like, you know, I have no idea, or I don't know how to do that. And I think that I couldn't be any other kind of leader, because I can't fake things really well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's okay. And I don't think I could be another type of leader, and I probably wouldn't be great for every organization, but I think that's kind of, you know, that just ends up being who you are.
Well, I love that. I mean, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about authenticity, whether you're an individual contributor or especially in a leadership role, And I think that that's what that is, right? I mean, just kind of being authentically human, responding the way that, you know, your brain and body and your mind and your heart want to respond to things. But having that EQ to kind of, you know, harness that where you need to and when you need to is okay too. So like that balance is important. I appreciate that. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you know, you talk about the HIV, and you got into the HIV research and stuff in the 80s, right? You
know, '85.
Was that like Ryan White that time?
Yeah, that was pre Ryan White. Yeah, that was like in the crazy moon suit era. You know,
I was thinking about this the other day. That like I wonder like, and I wanted to ask you this: what was it like, and what, you know, because HIV at that time, it was like, if you touch somebody with HIV, right, you were going to get AIDS and die, you know? And I almost felt like there was some parallels with kind of the whole COVID when COVID hit. Tell us a little bit about that. And like, you know, did that bring you back to that time frame? And what did you learn? And yeah, give us a peek behind there.
Yeah. You know, and I think the stigma that patients have, you know, during HIV and during COVID, there's parallels there too. And also for healthcare providers, I remember going to, you know, working on an inpatient HIV floor, and no one would float to our floor, even the other nurses. And when we went to the cafeteria, like, I know there are people who stayed away, and mm-hmm. and our social circles, even we were, you know, I think, but it also brought me closer to the community of the people I was taking care of, because, mm-hmm. and I only felt 10% of it, you know, of being ostracized and the stigma. But I think, you know, there's a risk to being a healthcare worker. And I think there's a responsibility to care for our healthcare workers. And I think following the science, you know, when during HIV, I knew how I could be infected and how I couldn't, you know, mm-hmm. and yep. I knew that gloves, I knew what I needed to do. And, you know, and just as people know, you know, knew during COVID, mm-hmm. you know, mostly, and there's always some element of risk, but I think the level of having what you need to care for your patients, the fact that people were making gowns out of trash bags in the richest country in the world is horrific. And you know, people should have taken to the streets because of that. And right. So, you know, I think that people put themselves at risk. And I think to not have what you need to do that is, I can't fathom it. And it must be so frightening to be providing care. Not, you're not afraid of the patient, but you don't have the resources that are readily available for you to have to take care of people.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. You know, so Sheila, so one thing about DJ that you should, DJ and I, that you should know is that we both have, we have a combined 6 daughters.
Ooh, wow.
We have 8 kids combined. DJ has 5 and I have 3 and I have all girls. DJ's got, for his first 3 were girls and his second 2 are boys. But we're girl dads. You know what I mean? We're girl dads. And
good thing.
And I when I saw that we were, you know, getting a chance to interview you, I was really excited because I wanted to ask this question about and get some advice and whatnot about that. So, you know, our daughters range from 3 to 12. So they're young. Mm-hmm. Like we're right in the thick of it.
Beginning. But
we expect that each of them will chart kind of their own course and, you know, find themselves with opportunities to be, fall in love with what they do and what they're passionate about. You know, many of them might have an opportunity to be women in leadership as they matriculate and grow older. But, you know, despite our own biases and blind spots, you know, we're never going to be women in leadership, DJ. We're in leadership, but we're never
going to try. But
right? That's never going to happen. And so, as fathers, though, you know, how do you think that we can help them? How, you know, we want to role model in the ways that we can, the ways that we are limited to do so, but also knowing that there's no reason why we can't role model for our young daughters and as they become women and everything. What do you think? Like, how can we model as fathers for daughters who at some point will become women in leadership themselves? What do you think? Like, break me off some advice there.
Yeah. You know, I think encouraging your daughters that they don't have to take on male attributes to be leaders. Mm-hmm. And I think kind of when I was growing up, the female leaders were people who took on more of the male attributes of maybe not being as emotional or being, or always being kind of the tough kind of leader. And, you know, men don't have to do that either. And I think that letting people know that they have to be authentically themselves, and mm-hmm. they can, and their connection to other humans, they shouldn't have to hide or put on or seem weak. You know, I think there's a, you know, growing up and now I'm in my mid 50s, but certainly younger women who succeeded are always those who acted more, you know, hid their female traits in some senses of you know, trying to act like they're only the role models they had were men at the time. So I think encouraging girls to be themselves and express themselves and not have to fall into those gender roles, just as we should be doing for our sons as well. Right. Yeah. And I think not letting the limits of people either. And, you know, young girls who are interested in medicine should become doctors or they should become nurses. Mm-hmm. Like, I think sometimes people are like, oh, did you, you know, you're smart, you should have gone to medical school. It's like, no, I shouldn't have. You know what? I'm a good nurse, and you know what? And strong young girls should become nurses or physicians. Like, we need to look at the full package together and not put people in boxes. And I think if we can do that, like, what an amazing place we'll have when people can, you know, be themselves regardless of kind of what stereotypes people think they should be in.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That's so good. That's good. So good. So thank you so much for all that. I mean, this has been great. A lot of stuff, very inspiring. Where can we find you? What's next? Like, where, you know, what, tell us a little bit about where we can find more of you.
Yeah. You know, I think as you know, people, you know, checking out Partners in Health, which is, you know, just PIH.org and join our movement for health equity. And looking at, you know, we're not just focused on the places we work, but really changing the movement overall. And that really we have to fight for health equity and fight for cancer care in Rwanda and Haiti and treat each other like we would want our mother and our sister to get care. So I think, you know, looking at that and also where can we take this time in the US to rethink of our, relook at our health system and push care, not, you know, not at a, from just from a hospital level, but we need nurses in the community. We need parish nurses. We need, you know, we need nurses who are you know, providing care in mosques and all over. And how do we change the healthcare system in the US to learn from our colleagues around the world who have really got it together, and we need to fight that they get what we have in the terms of the ICUs, et cetera. So I think this is a time where we can all ride this wave of caring for each other, and health is what we're fighting injustice by providing healthcare. And so people need to find what they're doing, but we all need to move together.
That's true. No, that's great. All right. Well, good. But we always, you got to answer some rapid fire questions.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready.
Five of those for you. So, all right, here we go. All right. You have traveled a lot. What is the weirdest thing that you've ever eaten?
So I don't know if it's weird, but my favorite thing is in Haiti, we have spaghetti and hot dogs for breakfast with ketchup. And it is the best thing in the entire world. So not weird, but maybe for breakfast.
Okay.
Like, I'm going to be cooking that up at that crib.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Like, tomorrow really morning, good. For Saturday morning, people are going to be like, what are you making?
Yeah,
like,
really good.
That reminds me though, like, you know, chicken and waffles used to seem weird, but now it's like, you know, it's chicken and waffles, right? So, so, all right. As a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wasn't a nurse. That's for very, that didn't appeal to me. I think I wanted to be a teacher. My dad was a teacher.
Okay. All right. My mom was a teacher too, as well. All right. What is your secret talent?
You know, I'm not really one for hobbies, but I'm really, really good at finding good TikToks and sending to all my friends. So I'm obsessed with funny TikToks. So that's probably my secret weapon.
That's nice.
Isn't that Courtney too, Harry? Doesn't she like to watch it?
Listen, Courtney, my wife, Courtney, Sheila, she's all over TikTok, but she's pretty good. I think she actually banned herself from TikTok for a little while. She needed a break.
Yeah. Oh, you kind of have to a little bit.
She was getting a little, you know, I'd be, you know, like when you're in bed and it's late and you're like, all you see is the ambient light. And I'm like, what are you watching? And she's like, nothing. I'm like,
I know it's kind of this embarrassing thing, but I'm out about it.
Yeah.
My kids are all over TikTok.
Oh yeah. It's hilarious.
All right. And the last book you read.
So actually, Paul Farmer, the, you know, the founder of Partners Health, just really, it's coming out next week, and it's called Fevers, Feuds, and Diamonds. And it's a book about, you know, Partners in Health, but about Sierra Leone and kind of the diamond industry and what it did to kind of lead towards the Ebola crisis in many senses. Oh, wow. And it's a, like a dense book, because Paul's books are really dense, but it's phenomenal. And it's, I got the pre-copy and I loved it. And, you know, disturbing the history of the diamond industry, but mm-hmm. really something people should read.
Wow. That's powerful. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. So great. It was really, Dr. Davis, really nice meeting you. Thank you for everything that you shared, really giving us a different look at things and opening our minds up. And we appreciate all that you did.
No, thanks so much. And I'm so excited. I love the Room Tilter thing. That's going to be my new thing. So great. You guys continue what you're doing, because it's great.
Awesome. Absolutely. Well, we appreciate awesome. It.
Thank
well,
you.
You have to come visit us again.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Let's right. let's hope for good news today.
Hey, yeah. There you go.
I feel you.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Davis.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
All right. We'll see you now.
You've been listening to the Room Tilters podcast. If you love it, do us a favor and rate us. Write us a review and share it with a friend. We appreciate you, our listeners. And remember, you don't have to be sick to get better.